We're going to talk about the Jerusalem Formula for Peace. The main theme is world peace through world law, and it's liable to raise a smile, notes, all over the place. That's Professor Attia. Where's Francis? You haven't got the... Oh, this isn't supposed to make noise, eh? No, this is just a lie detector. I'm going to put this out of the way here. However, this, now we've got to watch our grammar and everything with this thing working. It reminds you of Clarence Day's little rhyme, "Might and right are always fighting, in our youth it seems exciting. Right is always nearly winning, might can hardly keep from grinning." Or Reston's essay in the paper this morning. He devoted his time to the terrifying theme this morning that after all has been done, he says there's a dawning realization in Washington today that after the best plans have been made and been successful and succeeded, still the problem of world peace is hopelessly beyond our grasp. It's just too big for us to handle. That, he says, is the thing that's occurring to a lot of people today, not from doing the wrong things in the wrong way, but from doing the right things, the best thing they can do. It's still beyond our grasp. It's not the law you obey, but the person who enforces the law. As Brigham Young says, the law is for the lawless, you know this, and they're only ruled by force. But there's such a thing as good force, and there's an attractive force as well as a compulsive force. Stalin says that, you know, if we're obeying the law because we regard it as a holy thing, because we love it, we're still being forced, but we're being attracted rather than compelled in that case. Now the question arises, can there be some great attractive force that would bring about some sort of world peace without the compulsive force? This was the old Jerusalem formula. It's very ancient, very well established, and has been given lots of tries, and it's still being tried today. So that's what I'm going to talk about. The Jerusalem formula, it's the doctrine that peace will only come when the law goes forth out of Jerusalem, when all men are drawn toward it, when the law is given to the world as a holy thing. And it can't even be secular. It has to be given as a revealed thing. Now, this is a plan that people have reverted to again and again and again. I'm not going to preach about it, but give you a quick rundown historically on this. Well, beginning at a very late period, as you know, the Jews and the early Christians believed in the heavenly Jerusalem, that the earthly Jerusalem was a counterpart of it, that the heavenly Jerusalem would descend, that the earthly Jerusalem would rise and meet it sometime in the air, that the two would fuse. Meantime, on this earth, we have an earnest of the new Jerusalem in the actual Jerusalem that's here. And it had enormous appeal to people in those days. They made pilgrimages, you know, from a very early time. The Christians carried on the Jewish custom of pilgrimage. And during the Golden Age, from 212 to 330 A.D., the problem of the status of Jerusalem was very hotly discussed all over the Christian world. Where should Jerusalem stand? Just how literal? Just how near was a physical Jerusalem to a heavenly Jerusalem, to a spiritual Jerusalem, which could be used as a capital for the human race? The city of peace. Remember Jerusalem? That was the name. Jerusalem is the city of peace, the city of Salem. And the world hailed it as such. This was the Jewish tradition, the Christian tradition, and it was strongly felt that if there was ever to be peace, it would have to be from a government that would be established in Jerusalem by international agreement. Well, as I say, during the Golden Age, the doctors fought about it, and the pilgrimage increased more and more. Now, in theory, the doctors of the church opposed it very strenuously, but actually they couldn't resist the appeal of the image themselves. A good example would be the best. Two examples might be Gregor of Nazianzen, one of the great Greek doctors, one of the four great Greek ones, and Jerome, one of the great Latin ones. Gregory wrote some passionate letters telling Christians to stop coming to Jerusalem. They were coming from everywhere. He says, don't do it. You're ruining our whole Christian thesis. We believe the church is Jerusalem. It's spread everywhere. The peace of God is now everywhere. It's no longer centered in a temple or anything like that. Stop this foolish practice of coming from Jerusalem. Moreover, it's a threat to manner and morals and everything else. There are pickpockets. There are all sorts of temptations and immorality. It's a good thing not to do. But where did he write these stirring appeals? On his way to Jerusalem as a pilgrim. And Jerome wrote the same sort of thing, very strongly. It's a spiritual Jerusalem. Don't be tied to a physical place and an idea that there has to be a place where we get together and so forth. That's foolish. Uh-huh. But where did Jerome write his stirring appeals? From Bethlehem. What was he doing 15 years in Bethlehem? He lived there. He thought he'd be nearer to the Holy Center, nearer to the temple if he lived in Bethlehem. See, they couldn't resist this appeal. It's a very strong one. They succumbed to the image. Now, the great center of pilgrimage was originally the temple, as you know, and the Christians carried it on, but made especially the Mount of Olives their center. There was the footprint where the Lord departed. There was the place where he would set his feet again to judge the nations, and it was believed that all people would gather to that place. So all people still continued to come there. And they adorned the place most magnificently and fittingly to bear out this image, described by, well, we get to Beda later on. But in 330, Constantine, as you know, gave peace to the world, was the emperor of peace. He conquered the world, and he celebrated tremendous triumphs in Rome, and he built Constantinople to celebrate his victory, the New Rome. He held the peace of the church at Nicaea to impose the same spiritual peace on the world that he had imposed by force of arms. But above all, to crown all his life work, he built at Jerusalem what he called the New Jerusalem, a vast complex of buildings around a great cosmic dome over the Holy Sepulchre, which he regarded as identical with the Holy of Holies of the Temple of Solomon, continuing this hero-centric image, carrying it on. It was a tremendous show. And the bishop at that time was Macarius, who was a very skillful man for publicity. Jerusalem had lagged. He wanted to make it one of the big world cities. So he publicized this, the holy calling of Jerusalem, and miraculously they started finding everything that had ever been lost, everything that's mentioned in the Bible, the lost farthing and all the rest, even things that were mentioned in Proverbs and parables, all were turning up under the auspices of Bishop Macarius, who, as I say, was a great promoter. And he promoted this Jerusalem image and made himself head of many conferences that met there in this idea of discussing world peace, because for him, Jerusalem was the city of peace. And then another circumstance came along. Europe was invaded by barbarians, as you know. And they overran all of Western Europe, and they overran Greece, they overran Asia Minor, 250. They overran Spain, they overran all of North Africa, but they never got to Palestine. Palestine was an island of security. It was early recognized as such. And so we find in the 4th and 5th century, all the rich Romans were pouring their money into Palestine. Incidentally, this is an extremely well-documented period, the 4th and 5th century here, the one we're on now. And we have their letters and so forth. Fabulously rich Roman matrons and landowners who would liquidate their estates in North Africa, for example, and send the funds in gold to Palestine and invest it in real estate there and in buildings. And there was a tremendous boom. By the end of the 4th century, there were more than 300 major religious establishments in the little city of Jerusalem, which is a small walled town, it was then. More than 300. Meaning by religious establishments, not just churches, but especially libraries, hospitals, schools. They regarded it as the place where humane arts should always be safe and so forth. And for 100 years, it was the one island of safety in the world. This heightened this image. And so we get these stories of the great ladies like Flavilla and Paula, and oh, there are dozens of them, that send all their wealth to Jerusalem and became great patrons of Jerusalem. They endow the foundations, they move their houses there, they build big villas around the city, which number hundreds. The 6th and 7th century, there's a tremendous building boom goes on. It's, incidentally, the French archaeologist Hubert says an interesting thing about this. When we investigate these buildings, he says, everything, and in the records, everything has to be splendens, nitelans, nitens, micans, radians, coruscans, brilliant, shining, flashing, radiant, glowing. Everything was brilliantly and gorgeously surfaced and colored. This is when they adopted, at this time, the gorgeous golden mosaics that characterize the big dome churches all over Europe. They're imitated everywhere. But this was the idea, the heavenly city motif. The idea of earthly peace, they had to put all their wealth into something, so it went into these structures. But it's very interesting, he says, when you examine them closely, the engineering is very sloppy and inferior. The workmanship is atrocious. It is slovenly, bad work, badly done. Artistically, as matters of design and so forth, it's outrageous. But they loaded on the gold and the jewels. They had to invest their stuff visibly, so here it was. It's like a Kyrgyz tribes lady or something from the center of Asia that carries all the money of the family. Well, right down here, the Hopis do. You see these poor families where the woman wears a gorgeous silver and lapis lazuli or turquoise ornament all the time. Well, that represents the family's investment. Well, that's what Jerusalem was. It represented the wealth of the world. There was a big slump, and Justinian took over the cost of continuing this big building boom, and it practically broke the empire. He couldn't keep it up, and the stuff deteriorates. But then there was a... There were big fights with the Jews. This is typical, see? The world was at peace. It was the great, wonderful post-war world. It was the neon age. See, everything, it was this sort of thing. It was the glory of a billboard sort of thing. And They had nothing to do, as you well know, the bread and circuses. This was the great time of the circus factions. And the Emperor Phocis, the Byzantine Emperor Phocis, favored the Greens, and at Alexandria and all the cities, these fights were going on between the two factions of the circus, whether you were the blue or the red or the white or the green. And the Jews were on the wrong faction in Alexandria. He used that as a pretext. They had a big riot. He called out the army. He sent his general Bonosus to Jerusalem to suppress them and drive them out of the city completely, expunge their religion. There had been a terrible rivalry all along between the Jews because they were making the pilgrimage here too, and so were the Christians. And just as things were hot in a firecracker in the streets of Jerusalem, who should appear at the gates but the Emperor Chosroes of Persia, who'd come to seek vengeance against the Emperor Phocis, who was a bloodthirsty tyrant, and had put to death one of his trusted ministers, who had to be a good friend of Chosroes. Well, Chosroes used that as a pretext for taking Jerusalem in 614. Chosroes was married to a good Christian woman. They took the cross back to Edessa, they took good care of it, but that was an absolute world calamity. When 14 years later, Heraclius, the Christian hero, brought the cross back, that was a major triumph. And it's celebrated throughout the whole Christian world today, the Catholic, Orthodox, all the churches celebrate. This is a great event, the bringing of the cross back to Jerusalem. The center of the world order was again in Jerusalem. And then another bishop by the name of Modestus thought he would be the second Macarius and started again the same big boom. But it also attracted other people, and just 10 years later, the city fell to Omar, who transferred the whole Jerusalem image to Islam. He made it the first thing he did when he entered the city. Omar asked the patriarch Sophronius, he says, take me to the temple. And Sophronius turned red and green and everything else. Well, I'm sorry, we've turned that into a garbage dump. And it was, they turned it into a garbage dump because it had been the Jewish place. Well, he resolved thereupon to clear it off, immediately began work. Tells us how, a number of chronicles, how the Omar, who was the immediate successor of Muhammad, as you know, this was in 638, how he crawled through a sewer to get up there. And immediately that night, they started working, leveling off the place, cleaning it up, and there he built the great Mosque of Omar, as it's so called. That structure is now destroyed, but there's another in its place, which was to be a replica and a reproduction of Solomon's Temple. From then on, all Muslims were to pray toward Jerusalem. Later, they prayed toward Mecca. But Jerusalem was the world center. The world is divided into two sections. There's Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam. You've either submitted to the rule of God, or you're yet to be subdued. There are no other categories, and this is the Roman concept of the Ager Pacatus and Ager Hosticus. The world is divided into hostile territory and pacified territory, and nothing else. And coexistence is possible, impossible between them, because the Terra Hosticus is in a state of rebellion against God. This was the Muslim doctrine too, and Jerusalem was made the new center, but it was kept open to the Christians, and they kept coming. There's a very moving description in the Venerable Bede, the great Bede, the greatest historian of the Anglo-Saxon. He died in the 7th of May, 735, way back there. He describes a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and the most marvelous thing, he says, is that Mount of Olives. They have a big church up on top of it, but a special building. It's round. It has 12 windows, and they have a great circular zodiacal light, which is to represent the heavens. And they light that at night, and he says, from all the country round, you can see up there as if it were the heavenly city floating up in the air. And he says, it gives everybody goose flesh. He says, you realize then that this is really a piece of heaven. And they really thought of it this way. They thought of Jerusalem as actually being a piece of heaven on earth, a tangible piece of it. And this leads to a very interesting result here, as long as we're on Beda. As St. Augustine said in an earlier time, it was like sparks spreading from a central fire. The spark would spread, it would start its own fire. So they started taking pieces of Jerusalem, pieces of stone, pieces of wood, of course, pieces of the cross especially, to various parts of Europe, and each one would then become the center of pilgrimage in its own right, under the name of Jerusalem, or the Sepulchre, or the Temple. So all over France and Germany and England, you find temples, Temple Bar, and so forth. You find Sepulchre, Saint-Sulpice, and so forth everywhere. You find, Jerusalem, New Jerusalem in Spain, in Portugal. You find the New Jerusalem in Rome, where Henry IV died, in Jerusalem. You find the Jerusalem Chamber in Westminster, where there were pieces of the original. What they were doing were reproducing the grand original. But it was a network, and they were all centered around this one. And they had a very elaborate, incidentally, I have the exact references if you want me to give them. I'm not going to bother with that. They had a very elaborate system worked out by which the holiness of a place was directly proportional to its distance from Jerusalem. So a Jerusalem, 2,000 miles from Jerusalem, was just half as holy as one 1,000 miles from Jerusalem. And they imposed, you know, Charlemagne, this brings in Charlemagne now, imposed the Jerusalem tax. Every town... Well, and this was taken up by Alfred the Great in England in 883. In Bohemia, by the emperor. In France, it became quite oppressive in France. Every cottage, every village, every manor house had to contribute a Jerusalem tax. In England, the Jerusalem, a monk representing later on the temple or the... either the temple or the hospitallers, would go accompanied by the sheriff from door to door collecting this tax, and you had to contribute. It was then taken in leather bags to the nearest church known as the Temple or the Sepulchre. From there it was taken to the Temple, which still gives its name to Temple Bar, in London, from which it was shipped to Jerusalem. But this idea of world dependence, these little Jerusalems, these, you find many churches going by the name of Sepulchre because they had an original piece of the Sepulchre there, or Jerusalem, I say, or Temple. Temple bars and temple churches and so forth. It's a strange obsession. But speaking of Charlemagne, in 800, Harun al-Rashid was having trouble with the Umayyads in Spain, and Charlemagne was fighting them too, so he thought he could get Charlemagne's help very effectively by offering him Jerusalem, and he sent the banner and the keys of Jerusalem to Charlemagne in 800. When he received that banner and those keys, then he felt himself authorized to call himself emperor, world ruler, but not until then. 4 months before, he'd received the keys and the banners of the city of Rome in the same way. But it wasn't until he received from the Patriarch of Jerusalem, from the Byzantine Emperor, from everybody else. It was sent by a delegate. It was brought by the Patriarch himself, incidentally. And it was brought by the monks of that of a big monastery there that had been having a big fight with the Jacobites about something or other. But they brought him these insignia, and that gave him the right to rule the world. From then on, he becomes the Emperor Constantine. Then he endowed it very heavily. He set up hundreds of institutions there. Big schools, big hospitals, libraries, all sorts of things. Always this cultural fascination in Jerusalem. He wanted to make it a divine thing. Incidentally, this Jerusalem tax just continued the old temple tax to the Jews. Cicero talks about that in the Verres oration. He talks about Jews coming clear to Sicily to collect a temple tax for Jerusalem. Well, then comes shortly after, things were very bad in Europe. Bad years. In Ralph Glauber's chronicle, you see it rained too hard, and then it didn't rain at all. And this is basic in politics or anything else. And this end-of-the-world craze set in. Everybody was scared to death about the end of the world. This started big mass pilgrimages to Jerusalem. You find the Bishop of Bamberg, for example, leaving 4,000 people, armed and otherwise, to Jerusalem. You find the Duke of Hainault. You find very important people. Nobility would get together, as from Flanders, and lead a huge armed and otherwise pilgrimages. They weren't crusades, pilgrimages to Jerusalem. And then these were interrupted by the Turks. Then was when the Seljuk Turks took over. Muslims as such never stopped it. The dynasty of Harun al-Rashid never interrupted it at all. They encouraged it. But when the Turks came in, they were a different breed, and they started taxing them very heavily, as you know. It wasn't the prohibition entirely, but the taxing that was annoying. So when in 1085, Robert the Frisian took a large armband on a pilgrimage and visited all the holy places, defending themselves as they went and refusing to pay tax, that was hailed as a tremendous sensation in Europe. The Byzantine Emperor, the Pope, all the kings of Europe, and especially the people, it had a great popular enthusiasm, regarded this as the avant-garde of a liberating crusade. They showed it could be done. If we went there in arms, we could win the whole thing back. And the crusading idea spread, as you know, and then in 1095 we have the St. Bernard and the... launching the crusade at Clermont. But the sensation of this thing, everybody picked it up. It became a subject of popular songs and everything else. Robert le Frison, he was going to save the world. He became a great international hero. So the world started going back to Jerusalem. Now the Crusades restore, which have left us an enormous literature, as you know, the Crusades restored this image, this apocalyptic image of Jerusalem. They used the language of the Old Testament, but they always also used the language of the world in arms. They were going back for a showdown with the powers of darkness. They had cast down the gauntlets. This was to be a trial by arms in the feudal manner, a trial by arms in which the judgment of God would be made clear against the infidel. This idea, again, about the world being divided into two camps. In this case, it was the old East and West, and it was to be an Armageddon. After the First Crusade, immediately after, as you know, under Baldwin, they sent up the famous Assizes of Jerusalem. Now, it's been recently shown in a number of studies that the Assizes of Jerusalem were never meant to be seriously applied as the local law in Jerusalem. They were a model of world government and of feudal government. It's the perfect feudal government. It's the perfect model government. There's no indication even that any effort was made to apply this in actuality, the Jerusalem Assizes.
This is the end of side one. You may turn the tape over now to continue the program.